70 years ago, a 21-year-old woman named Ada Lois Sipuel walked into the University of Oklahoma's admissions office to apply to attend law school. She was immediately turned down because of the color of her skin. He didn't agree with the decision, but OU President George Lynn Cross had no choice but to deny the request, since state law mandated the segregation of public educational institutions. You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hartzinski. There were no surprises on that January day in 1946, and the ensuing legal battle made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court 2 years later, almost to the day. A 27-year-old law clerk sitting in a cane chair on the south side of the courtroom described the arguments by the NAACP attorney as respectful, forceful, and persuasive. John Paul Stevens would later sit side by side with that attorney, a man named Thurgood Marshall, for more than 15 years when they both served as associate justices on that very court. In that same 2005 address to the American Bar Association, Stevens described Ada Lois Sipuel as an excellent student who earned the respect and admiration of her white and almost exclusively male classmates. We're going to hear that story today from my guest, Cheryl Brown Whatley. She's a professor at the University of North Texas Dallas College of Law and the author of A Step Toward Brown v. Board of Education, Ada Lois Sipuel Fisher and Her Fight to End Segregation. It won the 2015 Oklahoma Book Award for Nonfiction. She started researching Fisher's life and legal case during her 7 years at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. Cheryl Whatley, welcome to Oklahoma Voices.
Thank you very much.
I want to start by having you describe the state of race relations in early Oklahoma. What were African Americans dealing with in the late 19th, early 20th century in Oklahoma Territory, and how did that compare to what we traditionally think of when we think of the Deep South during this time period?
Oklahoma has a very interesting history when it comes to race relations. Number one, Oklahoma had, as most people know, was the landing point for the Trail of Tears. And so in the 1840s and 1850s, we have the forced migration of the Native American tribes. We also have the Civil War. And once the Civil War was over, Oklahoma was called for many liberated slaves the new homeland. And it was the reason that Oklahoma became the home of the most black townships of any territory in the country. But there was an extreme tension between the white settlers of Oklahoma, the land-run pioneers, and the migration of the liberated slaves to Oklahoma. So from the very beginning of its statehood, the Constitution wanted to deny the right to vote to people of color. In the early 1900s, this was becoming even more stressful and more tense. And in the 1920s, the KKK was very involved and very active. So it didn't have a root in slavery. It had a root in the tension of emancipated slaves wanting to be able to have their own homes and towns, and they were successful. And that success caused problems.
The book that you're with me to talk about focuses on Ada Lois Sipuel Fisher and the path that she would eventually forge. In some ways, it starts even before she was born in 1924. Her parents lived in Tulsa at the time of the 1921 Greenwood race riots, and that eventually led them to Chickasha. Chickasha wasn't an all-black town like we think of when we think of Boley or Taft or Grayson, but it had a thriving black community. Tell me about her parents' background and that experience of growing up in Oklahoma.
So her parents were from Arkansas. Her mother was from an educated family. Her mother and her sisters had gone to a teacher's college and had actually been trained as educators. Her father was a minister. He became a bishop of the Church of God in Christ. They, as a result of his ministry, were appointed to Tulsa, where he held a church. And as you said, they were victims of the Tulsa race riot. Their home was burned down. Reverend Sipuel was actually one of the African-American men taken into custody and put in the holding pens, at which point they decided that they would not stay in Tulsa, and they deliberately chose Chickasha. Chickasha was interesting because it was kind of on the rails and the cattle industry type of thing in terms of beef being moved north and south and east and west. Reverend and Mrs. Sipuel were very, very active in Chickasha. Mrs. Sipuel actually was appointed to a commission that would help with the naming and location of a park for African-American students. There was a lynching in Chickasha in which it was determined that the sheriff actually assisted in opening the jail and allowing the lynching to happen. So in an act of kind of public courage, she created a bumper sign. She put a cardboard sign in the back of her car window that opposed his reelection during the campaign. So Mrs. Sipuel was very outspoken, very much a member of the NAACP and active in those efforts in Chickasha to secure equal rights for African Americans.
And how did Ada Lois Sipuel react to this growing up? What was her childhood like watching her parents be so involved in the struggle for civil rights well before we traditionally think of that beginning?
Right. And I think Ada Lois's story is the story of so many African Americans and that we have not yet fully embraced it. And by that I mean she was a child of her community. And African American communities, although burdened with segregation, nonetheless thrived because they made certain to provide for their children the love, the education, the consistency, the motivation, the religious inspiration, so that the children could thrive and survive segregation. And so Ada Lois attended the all-black school, was a member of the choir, was a member of the marching band, attended her father's church, attended all of these things that gave her a sense of self-worth and confidence. Because that's what African-American communities had to do to enable their children to survive the burdens and pressures that were being put upon them by the broader world. Watching her parents, her father, as I mentioned, there was a mob riot in Chickasha, and her father was one of the African-American men who took up arms, and they essentially put African-American families in homes, and the men protected those families while there was the unrest, mob unrest going on. So she certainly saw from her parents and the broader African-American community this sense of, we have value, we have worth, we are deserving, and we do not give in.
That desire to relieve some of those burdens and pressures that you just mentioned, is that what sparked her interest in a legal career at a young age?
Well, she tells a couple of stories or told a couple of stories about what sparked her legal interest. One was her mother's cousin, who was an attorney in Chicago, whom she had the opportunity to go visit during the summer. And she went to his law office and kind of was enthralled by what she saw there. Another source of inspiration was, ironically, a visit by Thurgood Marshall to her high school in the late 1930s or 1940s, just seeing Thurgood Marshall and who he was and what he represented through the NAACP.
And you've mentioned Thurgood Marshall several times now, and of course he, you know, later became well known as the first African-American Supreme Court justice in the late 1960s. He was widely known for his role in Brown versus the Board of Education, but he also worked on many of these early graduate school desegregation cases that you wrote about, and you described him in the book as very confident that they would succeed. Why was he so optimistic?
Yeah, I don't know that it was optimism so much as it was a sense of the merit of the strategy. If we take what was then the legal principle that the education had to be equal in order for separate and equal to be lawful, they were convinced that they could make segregation so costly that no state could continue to go forward. That's a matter of economics. That's a matter of math. And that's something that's hard to fight. You know, we weren't talking about morality. We weren't talking about religious propriety. We were talking dollars and cents, and Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston based it on a straight economic argument. And I think that's why he could afford to be confident. I think he was also confident in the tenacity and the determination. The fact that when you are on what I call a righteous mission, you don't simply give up in the face of adversity. And Charles Hamilton Houston is the one who conceived of the idea. Marshall was one of his kind of prime pupils, if you will, at Howard Law School. And the first lawsuit that the Howard group under Charles Hamilton Houston brought was against the University of Maryland, which had denied admission to Thurgood Marshall. And so he went back to the school that said, you deny me admission, we'll show you. And they did.
So it was clearly a personal struggle for him in a lot of ways. Going back to that righteous mission that you just mentioned, the NAACP still had a hard time finding plaintiffs for these lawsuits to take the lead in the challenges. Why was that so difficult? And especially in the case of the University of Oklahoma, why did Ada Lois Sipuel decide to take on that burden?
You know, when an African-American stepped forward and said, I will be the named plaintiff that is taking on, that is challenging, that's seeking to dismantle this state's approach to education, segregation, you're taking on the state. And there can be no mistaking the fact that that person was at risk. Their employment, their job, any type of dependence upon what I will call the white establishment was put into jeopardy. Their well-being. I mean, you know, we think now of just the – and it's a sad analogy but it's what is happening to Muslim communities and the fact that now Muslim homes are being vandalized. And just let's turn the clock back to the 40s where it was a legally sanctioned system of segregation. And how dare you challenge that? How much that person is vulnerable to you can't shop here. You can't eat here. Even more so than ever. And you put a target on your back as well as your family's back. So it took a great deal of courage on that respect. The other respect is that when we look at some of the earlier plaintiffs in the NAACP cases, we see that they essentially suffered what we would call nervous breakdowns. And in fact, Lloyd Gaines out of Missouri spoke a lot about his despair. That he thought he'd won and he'd be able to go to school, but now he was in limbo because you can't move forward with your life. You're waiting for the wheels of justice to actually achieve something. So for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, you really can't move on with your life. And that creates a personal stress and toll. So you have those two dynamics going. It makes it very, very difficult for an individual to have the ability to sustain that type of burden.
Tell me about the day Ada Lois Sipuel Fisher applied to the University of Oklahoma and her meeting with President George Lindcross in particular. How did the various levels of the OU administration react to the idea of an African-American applying to the law school?
Okay, so the story of that January 1946 day is really a tribute to Roscoe Dungy. Roscoe Dungy was the chairperson of the State of Oklahoma NAACP branches, the editor of the Black Dispatch, and he'd been the one who had really kind of identified and selected Ada Lois. And he is a master strategist in his own right. So he knew that what they were getting ready to do was fundamental. So he called Dr. Cross ahead of time and put him on notice that we're getting ready to come down. Masterful and turned out to be very brilliant. Whether or not he knew of Dr. Cross's reaction and what it would be ahead of time, or whether he was just doing that, which was probably politically astute. So the reporters were there. Roscoe Dungy, Dr. Bullock, who was the Chickasha NAACP representative, and Ada Lois go to register. She is taken to Dr. Cross's office. Dr. Cross says to them, in confidence, I want you to succeed. However, the State Board of Education had given him an order that if a Negro was to apply, he was to deny them admission. And so he had been given that express order. He said, I have to follow that express order, but tell me what I can do to help. And so Mr. Dungy said, we need a letter that makes it very clear that you are denying her admission because of her race, that she is in every other respect qualified to enter the law school, but the only reason she's being denied is because she's African American. And that was really important because at that time, Langston University was an unaccredited school. And so they could have said, well, we're not going to admit you because you're not a graduate of an accredited academic institution, an accredited college. That would have put the state of Oklahoma in a real kind of bind, if you will, because Langston was the only college that it gave to African Americans. It was unaccredited. So it would be, on the one hand, kind of denigrating its own educational institution for people of color and saying, yeah, we're giving you substandard education, and it's so substandard it won't even be considered. So Dr. Cross did not use that explanation. And so he wrote a letter, and it was a very straightforward letter. Roscoe Dungy was very, very pleased and excited about Dr. Cross's expressions of support, immediately rushed back to his office and wrote Thurgood Marshall. And in the NAACP archives is a copy of the letter that he wrote Justice Marshall, or then Thurgood Marshall, Attorney Marshall, saying that he's promised us his support. We cannot go public with it because obviously it will jeopardize him. But we need to know that we do have his support.
You had just mentioned that reporters were there the day that she met with Dr. Cross. And I was actually surprised at how much media attention this case received at the time. In a lot of ways, now this particular case with Ada Lois Sipial Fisher almost gets overshadowed by Brown versus Board of Education. But at the time, that was still 6 to 8 years away. How did the media react to this particular case with Ada Lois? And what were some of the differences between the local media reaction and the national media reaction?
Well, part of what we have to realize is that when we talk about history, we know what has happened. All right. When we talk about the event and the journalism coverage at the time, it's still, we don't know what's going to happen. Part of the reason it got such tremendous coverage is that in October of 1945, Thurgood Marshall went to the Oklahoma NAACP conference convention and declared that he could win a desegregation lawsuit in Oklahoma without any problem. That would probably be even easier than being in Mississippi. So he kind of laid down the gauntlet, if you will. He kind of said, Oklahoma, we're coming, which is what prompted the Oklahoma Board of Education to kind of say, no, you're not. We're giving instructions not to desegregate. So there was kind of this early pronouncement, and then here the day comes. You know, we take into the fact that Ada Lois is a very attractive woman of color. Family has economic independence in that her father's with the Church of God in Christ, and her parents are well established in their own right. Her brother is an Army veteran. It's kind of like a very nice starring character in this role that will unfold before her.
This may be a daunting question, but can you walk me through the legal process of this case? It went before the Oklahoma Supreme Court and then the U.S. Supreme Court. But what I'm also curious about is Ada Lois's attitude and how that changed through the appeals process. Did she grow more frustrated as this legal battle went on?
Well, you know, it's interesting. And the one thing I regret about this process is that I've never got to meet her and interview her personally. She did write an autobiography with her son, Bruce Fisher. And in that, she recounts some of her responses and reactions. So what happened is they filed the lawsuit. She applied in January of 46. The lawsuit gets filed in April of 46. The state of Oklahoma says, well, we can't immediately answer because we may be willing to create a separate law school for you. So give us some more time. They said to take a couple of months, and they ultimately come back and say, well, no, we can't afford to set up a separate law school just for you. So it's got to go to court. We got to take it to the courts. As fate would have it, there had to be three postponements, one because Marshall was involved in very significant litigation in Tennessee. It ultimately gets reset for July of 46. It's reset for that time because the judge has ruled that there won't be any further postponement because school is getting ready to start in August. So the NAACP and Ada Lois interpreted that as, well, the judge must be thinking about granting her petition. Because why else would he be concerned that school's getting ready to start, right? So they came up. They were very optimistic. None of the NAACP lawyers from New York came for the hearing. It was done by Amos Hall out of Tulsa. And it got very tense between he and the judge. And ultimately, the petition was denied. It was then appealed to the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And, you know, she was kind of disappointed because they really thought that denial of the continuance. So it was very much a letdown. It's argued before the Oklahoma Supreme Court in March of 1947. The Oklahoma Supreme Court is like, are you trying to say our Constitution is invalid? Our Constitution requires this. All over Thurgood Marshall in the oral argument, not surprisingly. And you know, Ada Lois recognizes this herself. It's going to be extremely difficult for the Oklahoma Supreme Court. And I think 5 of the 7 members were themselves graduates of OU Law School to go against their law school and say everything that you've been doing has been unconstitutional. And so they erroneously tried to distinguish the U.S. Supreme Court case of Gaines versus Missouri, but nonetheless deny her petition, her appeal. It then goes, they file a petition for certiorari, which is granted by the U.S. Supreme Court in the fall of 1947. They file their brief. They vet their brief. Oklahoma, through the Attorney General, files its response. They're preparing for oral argument. And one of the interesting things is that Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston would always practice oral arguments in front of Howard Law School students so that they would ask them the tough questions that they think the justices of the Supreme Court would ask. They then have oral argument early January of 1948, and within days, the U.S. Supreme Court rules. It's a 1-page per curiam rule, order that says the state of Oklahoma had to provide Ada Lois with a legal education at the same time that it offered a legal education to white students.
But they did wind up establishing a separate law school at Langston University, and they did it over the course of 7 days. Describe that process for me.
Well, it's amazing because what happens is the U.S. Supreme Court order is remanded to the Oklahoma Supreme Court, and you have 2 levels of board members in Oklahoma. You have the Board of Regents for the University of Oklahoma, and then you have the Board of Regents for the Higher Coordinating Board of
State Regents for Higher Education.
State Regents for Higher Education. Thank you. And so – they're kind of all looking for guidance. What do we do? What do we do? Oklahoma Supreme Court, because we don't want to violate Oklahoma law. Because at this time, a teacher could be fined daily if they taught a class that had black and white students in it, so as well as have criminal penalties. So you have this tension for them. So they turn to the Oklahoma Supreme Court for guidance, and the Oklahoma Supreme Court says, provide our legal education consistent with Oklahoma law. Well, that means it had to be separate. So it was the greatest farce that could ever exist. You know, the state of Oklahoma for months has been saying, we can't afford to set up a separate but equal law school. We don't have the resources. There isn't enough demand. There's no reason for us to do a separate law school. The Supreme Court says you got to give her legal education. All of a sudden, within 7 days, they can do that separate law school. A hubris is the word that comes to mind because it was amazing. So they hired three lawyers to work part-time. One is a dean, 2 as faculty members. They literally created a cardboard sign that said Langston University School of Law and put it in an empty room at the Capitol. They got the Board of Bar Examiners to say, yes, we'll allow a graduate to take the bar exam. They literally went and got OU Law School's bulletin and copied it and put a Langston seal on the front of it, even down to the fact that they were going to have a school newspaper. Well, wait a minute. I mean, no, that's just not going to – anyway. They did everything that is superficial in evaluating an institution and then literally pronounced, because what the Board of Regents said is that if – there is certification that an equal law school has been created. Dr. Cross, you cannot readmit her. You cannot admit Ada Lois when she seeks to reapply. And the board certified Langston University as being substantially equal to OU School of Law. It was amazing. It was insulting. Ada Lois was insulted by that, as were most of the African Americans in the state of Oklahoma. And I think more than anything, that, and the word that comes to mind is arrogance, is what mobilized white citizens of Oklahoma to join with the African Americans to say, we need to stop this. This is now ridiculous.
So once this decision finally comes down, and it does pave the way for many other African American students to apply to graduate programs at the University of Oklahoma, and even though her case laid the groundwork because of this Langston School of Law that had been established, she actually wound up not being the first African American to attend the University of Oklahoma. How did she feel about that, doing so much but not receiving the credit?
You know, she doesn't write about that and didn't really write about that. She writes about, you know, rejoicing in the fact that George McLaurin, Dr. George McLaurin, was accepted and enrolled in October of 1948. I think it's also significant that Delaware and Arkansas both voluntarily desegregated their graduate programs within a week to 2 weeks of the Supreme Court ruling. So other states recognized just it was an order. It was a mandate. But Oklahoma resisted that instruction. I think the other thing that's just really poignant for me in telling Ada Lois's story is if we think about what the struggle was. Now, this has been going on for 3 years. Just think about the high of that Supreme Court order. How excited. It's like, I get to go. And that crash when they say we've created this law school that's a sham, that's in your face. It's we're making a mockery of what you've been fighting for. To having to sit there and listen to people talk about this school is equal. When the NAACP presented the dean from Harvard, the dean from Columbia, the dean from UPenn, the dean from California, all of these legal experts. And what is she fighting for? She's fighting for the chance to go to law school where she'll be going to law school with white males with whom she's never been in an educational setting. She is going into a land that is totally foreign to her. And she's fighting desperately for that. That has got to be such an emotional experience, but it's one that she really never writes and shares with us.
And the Langston School of Law was eventually disbanded just a few years after it was created. And ultimately, that is what paves the way for Ada Lois Sipuel Fisher to go to OU Law. Once she attended OU, what was that experience like for her? How did her fellow students react to having an African-American in the classroom?
Yeah, and it was about 18 months. They created it in January of 48, and it was disbanded in June of 49. They spent about $15,000, $20,000 on it. By that time, African-Americans were in other graduate programs. And again, that was part of the strategic brilliance of Roscoe Dungee, because when the Supreme Court said you have to offer education, they immediately had more African-Americans apply. So African-Americans on campus were no longer the novelty as when she had initially applied and her order came down. She was welcomed. There were a group of law students who actually – school had been in session for a couple of weeks before she was actually admitted. So they got with her and gave her notes and provided assistance. But by and large, when I interviewed some of the alums from her class – it was we were busy with our lives, and everybody was kind of doing their thing. Everybody was studying, so she was no longer kind of such a focal point. Although Oklahoma required that they create an area where she would have designated seating, it was the designated colored seating area. Her classmates would remove those signs. They would remove one told of having like the theater velvet ropes dividing the area. They would remove those. Anything that where they had the opportunity to kind of protest against the obvious signs of segregation and differential treatment, they did. But in terms of totally making her one of the group, that level of what we would probably call social interaction acceptance, that just wasn't on their radar screen. So her life was a very lonely one.
And she graduated in 1951, and I love the fact that you have her graduation photo immediately behind you. I'm looking at it right now in your office. So tell me about her later life and legacy, and her involvement with OU really came full circle toward the end of her life.
It very much came full circle, but before that, she carried on the mission. You know, Ada Lois became the NAACP attorney in Oklahoma and herself participated as an attorney in the desegregation cases against the Oklahoma Women's College that was in Chickasha and municipal parks and some other junior colleges in Oklahoma. So she became very much involved in NAACP litigation. What she was never really able to overcome in her early practice, though, was the problems of developing a client base, the economics of being a lawyer and getting enough business to support herself as a practicing attorney. And eventually Ada Lois went back to Langston University and became a professor and director of their history, social studies, social sciences department. and then was appointed as a trustee to the Oklahoma University Board of Regents.
Finally, I want to go back to the opening lines of your book and a conversation we had as we were walking down the hall. When you asked yourself what you would have done had you been in Ada Loa Sipuel Fisher's position as an African-American woman trying to break down the color barrier at a law school, so I want to ask you now, what would you have done?
You know, I spent 5 years researching Ada Loa's story, and I still don't know the answer to that. I would love to think that I would have had the courage, because as the story goes, the NAACP actually approached her brother, Lemuel, and he had just returned from the Army, and he said, I don't want to put my life on hold. And she stepped forward and said, I will do it. To me, that's tremendous courage. That is tremendous faith. That is tremendous dedication. And there have been circumstances in my life where my life is on hold and has been on hold. And I know the toll that that takes. And I don't know how one anticipates the venom, because she did get hate mail. There was one letter that she received that was addressed just to Nigger, Chickasha, Oklahoma, and it got delivered to her. It's a question I still don't know the answer to.
Cheryl Watley, the author of A Step Toward Brown versus Board of Education, Ada Loa Sipuel Fisher and Her Fight to End Segregation. She's also a professor at the University of North Texas, Dallas College of Law. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Cheryl Brown Watley, the author of A Step Toward Brown versus Board of Education, Ada Loa Sipuel Fisher and Her Fight to End Segregation. You can watch a video tribute to Fisher created by the University of Oklahoma's College of Law on our website, kgou.org. You can also follow us on social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter at KGOU News. The views and opinions expressed this half hour do not necessarily reflect those of KGOU, our staff, or the OU Board of Regents, which holds our broadcast license. I'm Brian Hardzinski, and you've been listening to Oklahoma Voices.